Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberto's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories and meeting the people behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. And every Wednesday, I get to have these conversations on air, bringing the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by interviewing some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show live every Wednesday at 2 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. Today is all about women who grow food. In the first segment, I'll be talking to my favorite farmers and dear friends, Katie Baldwin and Amanda Merrow, who run Amber Waves Farm in Amagansett, New York. And in the second segment, I'll be talking to Julia Sherman, an artist who runs a website with one of my all-time favorite names, saladforpresident.com. All three of today's guests are committed to making our world full of very great produce and are tuned into the positive impacts that growing food has on our environment, our health, and our communities. So we're going to start with Katie and Amanda. Hi, guys.
Hi. Hi, Julia. Thanks for having us.
I'm so happy you're here. And thank you so much, not just for making the trip from Amagansett to Brooklyn to be here, but also coming during the height of your growing season. I know time is valuable. Let's go back a bit. I want to know where you each grew up. Katie, do you want to start?
I am a half Californian, half Texan. So Southern California and San Antonio.
What do you call that?
Texifornian?
A Texifornian.
It's an odd mix, but it's a good food mix.
Yeah, for sure.
You have access to the year-round seasonality of Southern California food, and then like you get deep into greasy Tex-Mex. So it's good food culture from
that
both places.
Like my heaven. What about you, Amanda? Where are you from?
I am from Southern Vermont.
So you guys are from very different places.
We are.
And I want to know a little bit about what you were doing before you ended up on the East End.
Mm-hmm. I took a job in foreign policy at the Council on Foreign Relations.
So totally related to farming.
In some ways. Kind of, yeah. I didn't really see the connections mm-hmm. until I actually got into farming. But I had this desire to want to work toward filling basic needs for people, so food, water, shelter. And food really struck a chord with me in the way that it was exciting and creative, but you could support community with it, and you need it every day. Mm-hmm. So the complexity of food took me in the farming direction from the foreign policy direction.
That's sort of pretty amazing. And Amanda, what were you doing before?
I was lucky to have found farming almost immediately after graduating from college. It wasn't the direction I thought I would go in. And I took an apprenticeship at Quail Hill Farm around the corner from our farm.
And that's where you guys met, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah. As apprentices at Quail Hill. And I thought that I would use agriculture or this apprenticeship as a leap to do something else, to work in development work abroad. And then really, I just fell in love with the work and the soil of Amagansett, and Katie and I hit it off, and I don't even remember the moment we decided to go into business together. It just always seemed like that was the next step from when we met, so we got very lucky in that way.
Yeah.
That's so wonderful.
It's great to have a good, solid business partnership.
Yeah.
And friendship.
Absolutely. I want to know a little bit more about Quail Hill, which is where you met, where you guys both did an apprenticeship, and that was sort of the beginning of everything for you guys, from what I understand. Tell us a little bit about sort of your mentor there, because I know you guys share the same one.
Yeah. So Quail Hill Farm is run by our mentor, Scott Chasky, and it is a project of the Peconic Land Trust. So we also lease land for the Peconic Land Trust. But that is one of the original community-supported agriculture farms in the state of New York. They have about 250 members, and they bring on apprentices, and they are training and growing new farmers. And I learned about Quail Hill Farm by reading Scott's book, This Common Ground.
In the farming community is kind of like a Bible.
Yeah, it is. It was an inspiring, poetic read. And so he taught me how to farm, and he taught Amanda how to farm. So a lot of our systems are based on systems that they have at Quail Hill Farm. including the apprenticeship program, which we've also mirrored, and we are also now training new farmers.
Which is amazing. You're totally, it's like full circle.
We made the agreement to, yeah, exactly, to pay it forward. Yeah. Because if, you know, unless you go to, you finish a program at an agricultural university, or you come from a farming family, your access to learning about growing food is pretty limited. And so these apprenticeship programs are very important to train new and up-and-coming farmers. So Katie and I made an agreement to really buy into that. So every year we have, it's of all of our crops, it's probably our most important crop is these apprentices who pass through the farm.
I love that. Yeah.
Who then hopefully fan out and mentor others and go on into, whether they go into policy or start their own farms or...
Yeah, planting seeds.
Exactly.
Totally. Yeah. That's so great. And was that something that you decided when you first started, or did that come later after you kind of, you know, had sort of established Amber Waves?
We knew we'd do it, but we worked for 3 seasons with just the two of us to get our own systems in place so that we would be organized and actually have something to teach when our crew arrived. So this is it. We're currently in our third year of the apprenticeship program. We have another fantastic crew this season that we are thrilled about and just couldn't do what we do at our farm without their enthusiasm and their hard work.
I mean, every time you add 2 more hands to your workload, it just, I mean, tangibly, it just makes like a huge difference. So
exponentially,
that's super.
It makes a difference in the physical workload, but also it's so exciting to see the new ideas for systems and the new enthusiasm and even recipe suggestions that our crew brings to the table. It's just one of the most exciting parts about our farm.
I'm sure a lot of what you do, I mean, even though you guys bring in new, like, you know, you didn't start growing wheat immediately when you started Amber Waves, like you bring in new things, but at the same time, it's pretty, I would imagine, pretty cyclical what you're doing, and maybe it gets repetitive. So I'm sure just having new people to talk to.
New blood to laugh at the same old jokes.
That's so funny. So I want to talk a little bit about the logistics of Amber Waves for anyone who hasn't been there. How big is the farm?
We lease on, like many young farmers and new farms, our field is split up into, or excuse me, our farm is split up onto 3 different fields, all of which we lease. We don't own any of those fields. So it's a total of 25 leased acres and about 20 that aren't in woods or roads or things like that. So we have 2 of our fields that are fenced in, protected from deer, which are a really incessant problem on the east end of Long Island, and then 1 field that's unfenced. And all of our acreage is split between vegetable and fruit production and the wheat.
So you guys are growing vegetables, fruit, wheat, but you guys also have chickens. Is that right?
We do.
Yeah. And are any other products coming out of Amber Waves? You're getting into medicinal stuff, is that right?
One of our apprentices started a culinary and medicinal herb garden.
That's so cool.
So that has that's in its third season.
That's
and
pretty amazing.
Coming back, having those perennials is really great. And then we had a CSA member who donated a fruit orchard. So that went in 2 years ago. So little by little, we're adding, you know, we had ducks this year, so we're going to do duck eggs.
Oh, no way. Wow.
Growing, probably looking toward growing the livestock component. That's something that's really important on a small scale farm, to have the ecosystem balanced between fruits, vegetables, grains, and animals. And that's something we're working towards so that, that we can incorporate
all of
those systems
together. Yeah, I think that's something that
isn't
totally understood by a lot of people. And it just, if you have all those things, they all, I mean, kind of literally feed each other, and
exactly,
makes a lot of
right.
sense. Yeah. How would you describe each of your roles? How do you divide up tasks?
Wow. We divided tasks. Well, we just got it done for 5 seasons. In season 6 this winter, we decided to divide and conquer. And so I am falling on the side of media and marketing and promotion and getting people to the farm and
making sure someone checks the email.
I'm doing right. I'm dealing with all the chefs and the restaurants. That's my role.
My role is I spend most of my day with the crew, and I manage the CSA. We have a 125-member CSA.
It's grown quite a bit.
We started with 18 members in
2009,
and many of whom are still members. And then we've added, you know, 20 to 30 per year. So it's been slow growth that we've been able to keep up with.
Amazing. And how many apprentices do you have at this point?
Five.
Five, okay.
Right now, yes.
That's so cool. And what's the yearly cycle like? Like, give me the breakdown for, I know right now a lot of stuff is, you were just saying the garlic just came in, you're about to harvest wheat. Like, what happens sort of over the course of a year at Amber Waves?
I guess starting at present time, the solid summer food is about to come in. So we're looking forward probably next week to cherry tomatoes. We had our first eggplant harvest this year. So it's the summer nightshade food. We have seeded and planted all of our fall crops. So all of those fall brassicas, the broccolis and cauliflowers and Brussels sprouts are in already. Beets and carrots are in for storage crops. And that sort of workload of solid food and the harvest, if you will, is going to happen for the next 12 weeks. Moving into the fall is a lot of work with schools again. When kids are back to school, we're a 501c3 not-for-profit educational farm. So we are mission-driven to teach kids about where their food is coming from.
So
they're coming
huge.
Onto the farm. Yeah. We're going into classrooms. That's heavy work for us that carries us through the fall. And winter is a lot of planning, hiring apprentices for the next season, crop planning, soil tests, field maps.
What's a typical day like in like February? You're on vacation.
sleeping on the beach in Tulum.
She's half kidding. Only half kidding. We are poring over the seed catalogs. We're usually in one of our living rooms, although now we have a heated office, which was a...
That's pretty huge.
Which is a huge...
That changes things.
It does. It's just a game changer. But typically we're in one of our living rooms with several cups of coffee poured over the seed catalogs and a pile of resumes for apprentices. And we go back and forth between the seed orders, the field layouts, interviewing people on the phone. And it's kind of just trying to get everything lined up.
So all this planning that goes on in the winter months is really serves you for like right now, like the middle of July through
this is when
September.
We love ourselves if we did a good job in the winter.
That's so funny. A running theme on the show has been finding out not just what women make, but also the business behind whatever it is they're making. And we've talked about a few of these things so far, but I wanted to ask you a few sort of business questions about running a farm, because it is like anything else, like running, you know, you are running a business. You have to pay your rent for these living rooms that you're moving in and everything. So my first question, which you've kind of tapped into, is you guys run a farm in the Hamptons, which is a place where the cost of land is arguably one of the highest in the world. From what I know, farming isn't necessarily the most lucrative job in the world. So how does that work? It's through the Peconic Land Trust. You want to tell people a little bit more about what that is?
Yes, we lease farmland from the Peconic Land Trust, some land which is owned by the trust, and then other land which is owned by a private landowner and managed by the trust, and then leased and farmed by us. And then we also lease from the town of East Hampton, which also preserves farmland and keeps it open and accessible to farmers.
It's like even more complicated than like a New York City
apartment.
So
like
we
most intense
so we cobble together, you know, these three, we cobble together our three fields, you know, in addition to the rental properties that we have for our apprentices, and kind of, you know, we're just spread out over Amagansett and East Hampton, which is a great place to be spread out over.
And the Peconic Land Trust was set up how long ago?
This is their 30th anniversary this year. Yes.
I think it's such a valuable organization because it is a place where it's become such a popular place, and land is kind of, I mean, just eaten up by homes. So to have someone who's really, or an organization that's paying attention to preserving a lot of what this, I mean, the Hamptons historically is farmland. It's like great, wonderful farmland. So
people who visit for the first time are surprised how much open space there is on the East End, and thank goodness that John Halsey had the foresight 30 years ago to realize what was coming.
Sort of crazy because 30 years isn't even that long ago, and so much has changed. So, so when it comes to selling what you grow, so Katie, you're sort of taking on this kind of more of like the marketing role. You guys have a bunch of ways of doing that. So could you outline, you have like CSAs, you have, or a CSA, you sell to restaurants. Do you guys still run the stand at the Montauk Farmers Market?
Yeah. We do. So we think of the farm in three pillars, and food production is one of them. And so our food gets on your kitchen table through a community-supported agriculture program. We attend two farmers markets, Springs and Montauk, and about 15 restaurant accounts in and around the East End. So Rushmeyer's and Mary's Marvelous and Provisions and... almond. These are kind of our workhorse.
Yeah.
Farmer-chef relationship and health food store, Naturally Good. These sorts of things are a good way to get food from a small organic farm out to as many people as possible. And I think that's something that Amanda and I think a lot about is it's direct sales through CSA and farmers markets and, you know, the farmer-chef relationship, but to create more avenues of food access for everybody. It's one of our firm beliefs that everybody should have access to clean, healthy, organic food. And so we're trying to up that all the time.
And what are some ways that you're doing that? Because I think that's kind of the most important question about what you guys do.
There are, access, having access mm-hmm. to good, clean, healthy, fair food is what is driving our mission. We're doing a farm-to-food pantry program. So that is a co-op of farmers in Amagansett that are selling food to a food pantry. I mean, it is just like moving as much local organic food to everybody who lives in the neighborhood as possible.
And not just people who are maybe in their like beachside like mansions, but also, you know, there's a lot of people who live there. And
Yes, there is a whole spectrum of the service industry and people who it's from the very wealthy to the very poor. I mean, they all exist on the east end of Long Island. We just want to make sure that our food
is reaching
gets on everybody's
yeah,
table.
That's so wonderful. I think it's just like such a hugely important thing about what you guys do. And I think also the education component to what you do is equally as valuable, because if you're teaching these kids to just what goes into farming and all that, you know, maybe they can go home and bring some of that to their families and everything.
It's the best way to access people is to get kids excited about pea shoots in the spring mm-hmm. and to, you know, to get them excited about whatever's in season. So a tasting tour is always part of a field trip at the farm, because if kids are able have power over their own picking and then smelling and tasting and talking about what they're eating, it brings up this level of excitement for them, and then ultimately an empowerment over their food choices. I think if you show that to them at, you know, age 3 or 4,
absolutely,
and through elementary school,
it's something that's so real, and as opposed to just an idea or a concept of like, you know, it's good to eat vegetables, but then like, I'm sure if they come visit you guys and see you digging the vegetables, or they can get their hands in there too, like, I mean, that makes such a huge difference, and it's so like practical. And the first guest we had on the radio show when we started was Kate Brashears, who runs Edible Schoolyard New York, and so we were talking a lot about that, and I think it's something I've kept in my mind as we've interviewed everyone, and you guys are such a great example of really making that happen. So that's,
and I remember those sorts of food experiences from when I was young. I would walk around Southern California and, you know, take kumquats off the tree and have this plum tree in the backyard, and there's very sticky food memories that
stick with you. Yeah. Did you actually, I meant to ask you that earlier on, did in your families, did you grow up with gardens, or like did you have access to farms? Was that something that you were familiar with? Or
it's funny. Well, in the 80s, when I realized now that my family was part of a CSA, but at the time I didn't know what it was. We just drove to this place. My mom picked up a box of stuff. But so that was going on. But when I was a kid, that wasn't really in my realm of what we were doing. My parents were into vegetables, but us doing the growing in our yard was not something that I was introduced to at all until I got to Quail Hill.
And my mom always kept a kitchen garden. Mm. So I had access to that and knew about that through her. And she's a very good cook, and food and fresh herbs right out of the kitchen door was something that
life.
I remember.
Yeah. That's amazing. And what do your families think about what you guys are doing?
They love it now. We have your stamp.
I should have asked
you, Julia,
5 years ago.
Yeah. Questionable answer. 5 years ago. What on earth are you doing? But I think that both of our families have been so supportive because they see how happy we are, and they see how passionate we are. And we have linked up with a lot of other women in food mm-hmm. and men in food, but that there is this, we're all part of this kind of tidal wave of
absolutely, yeah,
excitement and change in food. So there's
exciting.
There's a lot of familial support.
When they visit us on the farm now, I think it's the like the gravity of what of the transformation of the farm in the last 5 years has been a really exciting thing for them to watch.
Yeah. So. Do you put them to work?
We do.
Free labor.
My dad's a carpenter, and so when he comes down to visit us, we always just have a long list of work.
That's useful to have in the family.
It is.
It's like having like a lawyer.
It's excellent. So pretty much, you know, the times of year that my dad comes down, that's what happens. He just built us a grain dryer and fixed up an old silo for us. So
we're going
towards the wheat harvest. We actually have some equipment that we haven't had before.
Did he build your CSA boxes?
We build those.
You build them.
Yes.
They're beautiful. He
does cut the wood for us. He pre-cuts
the
wood.
Katie and Amanda brought a CSA box with them. They're gorgeous. They're really simple boxes with rope handles, and I love them. And I think if that's what I was picking up my food in every week, I'd be really, really happy. That's so great about your dad. I want to go back to just a few of the business questions. One is, how do you determine what you're growing? Is it based on demand? Is it like, oh my God, everyone is like addicted to kale, so we're going to grow a ton of kale? Or is it more about like introducing your audience to new things they haven't seen before, like that you might find in the seed catalog, a bit of both, or something altogether different?
It's a mix. You know, we want to grow things that we're good at growing. And, you know, it's early in our, maybe after our first season, when we went to the Young Farmer Conference at Stone Barns, and Jack Algier, the farmer there, kind of gave us permission to just don't grow things that you don't like to grow and that you can't make money on. Just don't.
That's good advice. I mean, that's kind of like anything. It's like, as a writer, it's like I've, you know, in school when I studied writing, the advice, you know, it's like that obvious thing of like, write what you know or what you care about, and will be much better.
Yes. And grow what you like to eat, because you're going to pour more love and care into that. We've struggled with things in the past like fennel and some other things, which I've really come around to and we're doing a really good job at this year. But in the beginning, it's something that if you don't want to eat it, you have a hard time putting the love into it to grow it.
So we listen, we pay a lot of attention to the things people are asking us for at the farmer's market. So there were, before we were growing the Japanese eggplant, the long slender eggplant, people were asking for it like crazy. And so we started growing it and people are pleased with it. And then a couple of years ago, it was the Sicilian eggplant that people want. So we grow what people ask us for and then also what we love. You know, bok choy is something that, if you're a foodie, you're eating in the Asian fusion restaurants, then you're really familiar with it, but not everyone is, and it's something that we're pretty good at growing, so it's one of those things we really try to drum up excitement for it.
And what are some ways that you do that? Is it like when people pick up their CSA boxes, do you chat, or like, how does that happen?
Yeah, most of the interaction on the farm happens on CSA pickup days, Tuesday and Saturday. There's a 3-hour window. So there is recipe sharing and we sell seedlings in the spring. So a lot of our CSA members are keeping their own gardens.
So that's so cool.
So it's plant talk. It's kitchen table talk. It's what'd you make for dinner last night? One of our board members, Julie Resnick, just started this great website. It's a recipe sharing website for our CSA members.
That's so wonderful.
Called Feed. So
if you're not a CSA member, can you access it?
You can.
Yeah?
Yes.
That's so cool.
So it's nice to know what your other CSA members, everybody's getting the same box every week, but everybody's doing something very different.
It's kind of like that, Chopped on the Food Network, where like everyone gets that mystery box and it's like, what are you going to come up with? And you like, and all of a sudden their things are so different. So it's going to be the reality
surprise
show.
Every
week. Yeah, it really, your personality really comes out in what you decide to grow in there. What we decide to grow. It's our personality coming out, but then, you know, for our members, what they decide to do with it.
I mean, the food trends also that we see, though, I mean, we started the farm in 2009, and I remember reading a recipe, Dan Barber kale chip recipe, in the Times, and I just couldn't foresee the kale craze that was about to descend upon us. But we are now growing 20,000 kale plants, and
That's
we cannot keep up. Every salad is a kale salad. Lettuce is out. Kale is in. Collards are the new kale. I think they're collards in your box today,
totally.
Julia.
People keep asking us, what's the new kale? And then we look at our kale field, which is, you know, a couple acres of kale, and we just say, kale is the new kale. Kale is still the new kale.
Keep
with kale. I love that. Have you seen that picture of Beyonce? And it's a sweatshirt that looks like Yale, but it says kale.
Yes.
Pretty great.
We talk a lot about making a kale kini. Kale, you know, like a woven together kale bikini.
I thought you meant kale martini. Oh.
That's what I was thinking.
That'd be a kale tini.
I think anyone wearing a what did you call the kale?
Kale-kini.
A kale kini. I think anyone wearing that is probably drinking kale-kini. I think it's the same customer.
Probably had the drink first.
That is hysterical. What do you think is, I mean, do you think there's any new kale? Do you think there's any ingredient right now that's...
The shishito pepper.
Really?
Yeah. It is the new kale, actually. That's the demand coming from chefs.
I'm going to quote you on it.
Okay, great. I think, yeah, I mean, we're seeing such high demand for a shishito pepper that we chose to quintuple the amount of plants that we did from last year. So we're going big on shishito peppers this year.
Here's hoping. Yeah. No, they're delicious.
They are.
I think, and what I mean, I think both those ingredients are also like pretty simple to prepare. So I think that's probably appealing for a lot of your, you know, CSA members and stuff.
And that's important, I think, in something, you know, we're taking it home. Last night we had a little birthday celebration for Amanda and we threw
happy
the shishito. Happy birthday.
Was yesterday your birthday?
Monday. Yes.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Broiling shishito peppers.
Couldn't be easier.
Yeah,
delicious.
Right, exactly.
Salt.
Or the week before we put them on the grill. Or it's like kale on the grill. You know, very simple preparations, I think, is what our food philosophy
I'm gonna
is.
I'm going to add a little personal recipe note, which was Grace, my wife, and I were just away for 2 weeks, and we were staying in a house that had a grill, which is my fantasy because we can't have one on our fire escape in Brooklyn legally. So we eat a lot of kale, and... my big goal over vacation was not to do a ton of dishes. So I started chopping it up, mixing it with some like oil and garlic, wrapping it in tin foil, putting it on the grill while I was grilling whatever else. And then it comes out like perfectly sauteed kale with garlic, but there was zero cleanup and I like could not have been happier. So that's my summer recipe.
Nice.
I mean, when I turn my back for 30 seconds, Katie has every single thing we grow on the grill. The girl is a grill master. She will grill anything and it will come out well. It's the Texan in her.
We also had on the show Elizabeth Carmel, she's the executive chef of the Hill Country restaurants.
Oh,
and she
yes,
runs a
right.
website called girlsatthegrill.com. And so it's all, she would be very happy to hear that. That's pretty great.
I'd love some tips from her.
I want to talk for a second about your wheat project, because I think it is pretty unbelievable, and you guys are some of the only people who are growing wheat on the East End, but historically wheat was grown on Long Island. From what I understand, it kind of went out of fashion as a crop when bigger farms in the Midwest started growing it in, you know, huge, huge quantities. How did you decide to bring it back?
In our long days of talking at Quail Hill as apprentices, we were just marveling at the bounty of the food shed on the eastern end of Long Island, and we're lucky to be, you know, to have so many fruit and vegetable farms and then also be right by the sea. So we also have access to arguably the best seafood in the world off of Montauk. And there are also breweries and vineyards, and there's honey and cheese and dairy, and there's really
salt.
And salt. Yeah, there's really everything, but this grain component was missing. And, you know, Dan Barber has a really eloquent way of saying, why would you outsource like the one of the staples of your food? Like, don't fill in the edges. Really think about bringing some of these staples back to strengthen a regional food system. He says it more eloquently than I just
said. No, I think we summed it up.
And so we started to get really excited about bringing wheat to the East End and getting, and we knew we couldn't do it, couldn't grow enough wheat for the East End by ourselves, but thought we'll do it for a few years and get other people excited about it. And so this season, it's Amber Waves has grown. You know, we have our own wheat crop. Quail Hill Farm also has wheat in the ground. And then another farmer friend of ours who runs Mecocks Bay Dairy also has wheat in the ground. So that's been really exciting to see it grow. And to our happy surprise, we thought we would be doing a lot of milling with the wheat and selling whole wheat flour. But in fact, the wheat berry craze hit.
The wheat berry kale salad
we put them happened.
Together.
We're like, wait, so we'll just do
everyone
less
went
work.
Gluten-free, so that's kind of a problem.
So
we'll work on that.
We do less milling and more. We do mill. There's a bread share associated with our CSA mm-hmm. vegetable share, and our fantastic baker,
Carissa Wechter,
yes, of Carissa's Breads. She mills a lot of our wheat into flour that goes into the loaves of bread for our CSA every week.
That's so cool. I think that's like one of the most amazing collaborative farm stories I've ever heard of.
We're so excited about it. And, it, we grew wheat for a few years before we actually got our own flour into the bread. And then, but it finally happened last year, and it was just, felt like such a victory.
I think that's just awesome. You guys are, I could talk to you all day, which I feel like I may have already. So I'm going to do the most abbreviated version of the Cherry Bomb Q&A, which are rapid fire questions we ask each guest. So I'm just going to ask you each the one question, which is my favorite question, which is, what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Lasagna.
What about you, Amanda?
Wow, I just didn't see this one coming.
It wasn't kale salad.
No, I think probably ravioli or ravs, as my mom might call them. You guys want ravs? Yes.
That's so sweet. I want you to open a restaurant one day called Ravs. That would be great. Katie and Amanda, thank you guys so much for being here. It means so much to me that you came. When we first started the show a couple months ago, you guys were truly the fantasy guest I had in mind. I think you represent everything right in the world of food. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back with Julia Sherman.
Thank you, Julia. Hi, I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. Do you love us? Do you really? Do you count on us for real food news and content? Because we need your help. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a nonprofit organization, which means we depend on underwriting, grants, and the support of members like you to keep us broadcasting. Help keep our voice alive. Visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org and click the donate button today. We promise to never stop in our mission to create a world that's more sustainable, equitable, and delicious, and to continue expanding the way eaters think about food. Thanks for listening, and thanks for showing your support.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. We were just speaking with Katie and Amanda from Amber Waves Farm, and now we're going to turn the microphone over to Julia Sherman. Hi, Julia.
Hi.
An easy name to remember.
Yes.
I feel like I'm full of personal anecdotes today, but my first year of college, my roommate's name was also Julia, and my dad could never remember her name. Okay, anyway, on to saladforpresident.com. My first question is, how did you come up with the name? Because I love it.
It was a kind of a secret blog for a little bit. It came from another blog that my husband had set up for our nephew when he was born, and it was called Dylan for President. And it was, the idea was that he would have a blog that his parents would maintain for him as a baby, and then he would take it on and have it for his whole life or whatever.
That's so sweet.
But nobody ever did anything with it, so it was a kind of a
Dylan
missed opportunity.
Too young to type.
And anyway, so the name got recycled into my project.
That's so great. And so when did you start the project?
Well, it was something that had been set up about maybe like 8 months ago, or actually, like, the blog existed probably a year and a half ago, and then I only got really serious and mildly obsessive about the project probably about 6 months ago.
And what do you do when you're not working on the site?
I'm a visual artist, so I'm primarily in the visual art world. I'm a photographer, video artist, performance artist, and writer. So, but I am always cooking, so this has sort of been like a natural
place to
extension.
Put it all together.
Yeah.
And tell us a bit about the content that's on the site.
It started out with just my recipes, and I started playing around with taking photos of the food. And I've worked as a professional photographer in many different capacities, but I had never taken food photographs. So I was really turned on by it, because as I started to do it, I couldn't quite put my finger on why a lot of the pictures look so disgusting. Because food photography, you really need to know the tricks, like the things that look good in front of you.
I think that's a very deceptive thing, and I think people assume it's really easy because it's
sort of, it doesn't move. It's not like having a mall or something, but it's, food is very much alive and, you know, needs right lights and props and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I started to just be, I am always cooking and always entertaining. And when I'm not in my studio, I'm always been somebody who deals with stress or any, by going to the supermarket and buying food and then coming home and cooking and inviting everybody over. This is not how most people deal with stress. So I started to make my own recipes and to photograph them and then do some writing. And it was really nice to me, for me to have this sort of consistent practice where a lot of the projects I do in my art practice are very long and very research-based. So this was this thing I could do as regularly as eating. And then I started to think about, and then as I started to talk to people about it, everybody was like, oh, I have the best salad. I'm a salad expert. People who you would never have thought would even be that into cooking. And so I started to go to other people's houses or their studios or their workplaces or whatever, and we would make a salad together and take photos and then do an interview. So now it's sort of a site that I like to think of as having multiple points of entry. So you could go there if you don't cook at all, just to read the editorial content and look at photos with really interesting artists and musicians and, you know, people working in the food world or whatever, whoever they may be. Or you can go there because you need a recipe to make tonight, or you can go there because you like to look at food photography.
Oh, that's awesome. I think it was so smart of you to sort of narrow down on this one dish, essentially, which has, you know, infinite variations. There's a billion types of salads that you can make. But just having this one sort of access point, like, I think unifies the whole thing. And I don't know, I really enjoy it. It's also really cool because you do have access to really interesting people, like you were just saying. And I always say, like, you know, everyone eats, so it's like, if you're showing what, you know, perhaps like the art world eats, like, that's a whole other lens.
Yeah, it's kind of a low barrier for entry, because if it was baking for president, it'd be really hard to find, like, those amazing artists who also are really good at baking and have something to share.
Oh, I thought you said bacon.
Bacon. No, that would probably be easy. We'd just eat bacon and talk. That would be probably a better idea. A lot less work.
Run both salad for president and bacon for president.
Just to see which wins. It'll be a presidential campaign.
That's so funny. Yeah. That's hysterical. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing at PS1 this weekend, because that is kind of bringing this to life in a very awesome, awesome way.
Yeah, so I guess, like, I have gardened for a while. I used to live in L.A., and I learned how to garden first in Providence. My husband had a small plot at a community garden, and I really got hooked on it when we moved to L.A., and I thought I was this amazing gardener because everything was growing. And then I moved back to New York and I made a rooftop garden at Columbia when I was in grad school, and it was an epic failure. Oh, I shouldn't say that actually on the air, but whatever. Anyway, we didn't build irrigation. And so, of course, everybody in the MFA program said that they were going to help out and go up and water every day. And then as soon as summer hit, it fried. And, you know, when there was 2 days, we couldn't be up there. So I was eager to have another shot at making a rooftop garden, and at PS1 they have this amazing space up there, and it wasn't, they had made, there had been an attempt to get together a garden last year as part of this show Expo 1, but it hadn't really taken off, and so the idea was to make a salad garden on the roof, and now it's open to the public, so museum goers and people who, and the museum staff use it as a sort of public outdoor space, and they can pick things from the garden, take things home, or there's also a little cafe that M. Wells Dinette runs up mm-hmm. there, so people have seen people adding herbs and greens and stuff to whatever they've bought for
lunch.
Yeah, so we've been doing this. My garden collaborator's name is Camilla Hammer, and she's a garden designer and an urban farmer. So we've had this really wonderful collaboration because she fills in all the holes of, like, technical knowledge that I lack, and I have lots of enthusiasm. So, so we built irrigation, and it's a big, thriving salad garden. So this weekend we're having sort of what's the official opening, and it's an event to celebrate the aspect also of the project, which has been for Salad for President. So artists who have done projects at PS1 come up to the roof, and they make a salad with me. I'm doing one this afternoon with an artist named Liz Deschen. She's amazing. So artists will come, we'll make a salad, and then while we eat the salad, we do an interview, and the interview is generally about the things that they love to do that fall outside of their practice. So for me, that's always been cooking and gardening. Now those two things are merging. But So the event this weekend is going to be the opening, and there's going to be salad and cocktails by my friends Danny Kent and Arlie Marks are making like crazy infusions, and Danny made vermouth from the herbs that I'm growing, and then Gotham Greens is donating extra salad greens and good eggs, and it's just going to be like a big food garden party.
Yeah. And so what time is it?
It's from 4 to 7:30, but Sunday. It's actually invite only.
Okay.
But I will vlog about it, and you'll see lots of pictures. It'll be in Cherry Bomb.
But the garden will be
The garden open. Is open whenever the museum is open, and there's a little map, a plant map, if you have questions and stuff like that, and then I'm blogging about the things we're growing and you know, aphids and irrigation and all the things that all garden drama. Yeah,
that's so cool. I want to, because you were talking about some of the other people who are going to be working with the event and everything. I think you've done such a tremendous job with collaboration. Also, you know, of course, all the artists you've worked with. I think one of the most interesting stories I heard about your project is a collaboration that you did for your mulch in the garden.
Oh, yeah.
Could you tell everyone about that? Because I think it's just, I thought it was like mind blowing.
Well, as an artist, you get really good at getting shit for free. Oh, I can say shit.
Oh,
yeah.
That's fine.
You get your, that is like essential, an essential skill to be an artist. So I get a little bit carried away with that aspect of it, as you can see by the list of sponsors for this event. But and this was Camilla's idea, and I was so excited about it. But so we were trying to figure out how we can make this garden with at least the least amount of money as possible. And one of the things was mulch, and because it's a rooftop garden, there's a lot of sun exposure, and to keep the water in, mulch was pretty important. So we got all of the byproduct of the shelling of the cocoa beans from Mass Brothers Chocolate in Williamsburg, and they opened a spot also in my neighborhood on Washington. And so when they process the cocoa beans, there's a shell that's almost like a nut, like a pistachio nut shell, skin, and that gets tossed out, but you can use it as mulch, and it smells like the most intense brownie, and it's really beautiful, and it's free.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And sort of reason enough to go visit is just to inhale.
Yeah. I drove around with it in the back of my car for like 2 weeks, and then we'd like intentionally park the car on the sunny side of the street so it would bake, and like it was this amazing air freshener. Highly recommend it.
I had never even thought about using that sort of chocolate byproduct, but just brilliant.
Yeah.
And totally, again, like full circle, like no waste and all that. Awesome. I think what you're doing is so cool. I really encourage people to go visit PS1. And if you're not in New York, just go to saladforpresident.com.
Yeah.
Julie, I'm going to ask you some more of the Cherry Bomb rapid fire questions, because I left a little bit more time. One, sweet or salty?
Salty.
Salty. Two, what did you have for breakfast today?
Oh, I make really elaborate breakfasts. I feel like most people on your show say coffee, and I'm like horrified. I get up extra early to make. I had 2 eggs sunny side up. I had an herb salad, toast with pesto.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
That sounds delicious.
People like sleeping over at my house.
What time does breakfast happen? Just out of curiosity.
It happens at 7.
Okay, I'll be there. What are you reading right now?
I put a book down, and then I just took it back up. Rachel Kushner book, Telex Cuba. Mm-hmm. Really good.
Great recommendation.
Yeah.
If I were to look into your refrigerator right now, what might I be surprised to find?
My refrigerator is somewhat of a portrait of me, so I'm not sure you'd be that surprised by anything, but there is like a gallon container of homemade sauerkraut that's rather intimidating. We had people house sitting and nobody touched it, I noticed, so it's a little, that's something.
Yeah. What's your go-to snack?
Salad. And popcorn, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love making popcorn.
What's your favorite time of day?
8 a.m., because that's when we take our dog to the park and have the quiet go-getter morning.
And where do you want to travel to next?
Oh, everywhere. Japan, Greece. Japan, though. I've been
good
saving
salads.
It. Yeah. Good salads that I wouldn't make.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
My mom used to make this, you'll appreciate this because she kind of actually has hair very similar to you, and she used to make this pasta carbonara with fresh peas, but the pasta, I don't know what it's called, but it was a long corkscrew, and it looked like her hair. And
oh,
I had
that's
a,
so funny.
I had a, I was really into playing with her hair, and so I liked that pasta because it was all the things I loved.
That sounds so great.
Yeah.
I love a carbonara with peas.
I think
it was pretty perfect. I think pasta is the the go-to, and I'm happy you broke the kind of the coffee mold for breakfast.
Yeah,
that's important.
Yeah.
Julia, thank you so much for being here today.
Sure.
Your site is saladforpresident.com, and the garden will be at PS1 through.
We haven't said. I think that we'll probably be doing it through October, and I will be posting stuff on the website about maybe some harvest events and things like that, because it's M. Wells is using some of it as well, but. It's way more salad than
cool.
I can consume.
Yeah. that's a good problem.
Yeah.
Katie and Amanda, who were on earlier, can be found online at amberwavesfarm.org. And if you happen to be out east, definitely go visit them. Their farm is right off of Montauk Highway, just behind the Amagansett Farmers Market. If you reach the fire station, you've gone too far. thank you, everyone, for listening. Tune in next Wednesday at 2 o'clock on Heritage for another episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.